I think we all start with muscle and we think about mobility and we think about athletes. But certainly as we get older, our functional mobility is a big issue. I always like to, make people aware that, for people who get beyond 60, 65, one of the major problems with long-term health is falls and breaking, fractures and things. There are 300,000 hip fractures per year in the United States, and one-third of those people never leave the hospital. So mobility and becoming more frail and all that is a major issue for keeping muscles healthy. So that's certainly part of it.
It isn't about being perfect. It's about being better. Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Stima, and I host expert discussions with thought leaders in all facets of health, including nutrition, fitness, hormones, stress management, performance, recovery, longevity, health span, and energy production. On this show, we discuss complex science, but then we also alchemize it into actionable everyday living. The ultimate goal with the show is to assist you in making informed decisions about your health and to catapult you into being the hero in your own life. Hello, Betties. Welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And today I am bringing you a conversation with Dr. Don Lehman. He is the OG on proteins and amino acids. So get ready for a masterclass on that. A little bit about Dr. Lehman. He's a professor emeritus at the Department of Food and Science, Human Nutrition at the University of Illinois and Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Lehman served on the faculty at the University of Illinois from 1977 to 2012. He's been a leader in research about protein, nutrition for athletic performance, obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular health. He has over 120 peer-reviewed publications. Many of them were quoted in my book, The Betty Body, because I've been such a huge fan of him forever. He received numerous awards for his research from the American Society for Nutrition and the National Institutes for Health and for his nutritional teaching. He has served as an associate editor at the Journal of Nutrition and Journal of Nutritional Education and Behavior on the editorial boards of Nutrition and Metabolism and Nutrition Research and Practice. He has an extensive consulting background, including working with NASA, the Shriners Children's Hospital, the U.S. Air Force, plus numerous food companies and organizations. So what did we talk about today? Well, we talk about the difference between protein intake and amino acids, and what are some of the amino acids, the 11 that we can synthesize and the 9 essentials that we need to find in our diet. We talked about protein quality, so the difference in proteins among animal proteins and plant proteins, protein dosing. We talked about training and how we can think about removing our muscles from a catabolic state through the use of a chemical stimulus like protein and also mechanical stimulus like resistance training. We talked about the concept of a carbohydrate load tolerance. So we, in the same way that we need a minimum effective dose of protein, we talked about minimum and maximum amounts of carbohydrates and how to think about those versus whether you are training, a resistance training session, or a cardiovascular session like a HIIT session. We talked about fiber. We talked about mTOR. We talked about some of the fallacies in the blue zone research and how we actually need more protein as we age. We talk a lot about women and protein and the overall, what I have found anyway, resistance to consuming more protein as ladies and what happens in perimenopause and menopause. You are going to absolutely love this man. He is someone that I have followed for many, many years, as I mentioned, extensively quoted in my book, The Betty Body. And it's such a pleasure to talk to the OG, if you will, the grandfather of protein and amino acids. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Donald Lehman. Phospholipids are the building blocks that make up your cell membranes, and they are responsible for allowing nutrients in and waste products out of your cells, as well as protecting your cells from toxins and invaders. You lose phospholipids as you age, so both our production goes down and they become damaged from exposures to things like glyphosate and heavy metals and all those other fun chemicals and pesticides that we're exposed to on the daily. This is where BodyBio PC comes in. BodyBio PC is a liposomal phospholipid complex designed to nourish your cells for healthy aging, optimal brain function, gut health, a better metabolism, and much more. BodyBio PC contains concentrated levels of phosphatidylcholine, which is essential for memory, phosphatidylethanolamine, which is vital for mitochondrial function, and phosphatidylinositol, which is supportive to the brain and neurotransmission. Prioritizing your cellular health is absolutely foundational for your health and well-being as you age and you are navigating perimenopause. You can save 15% off of your first order with code BETTER at checkout at bodybio.com. So head over to bodybio.com/better and use BETTER at checkout. I am on a mission to have my best skin ever this year, and I am absolutely in love with Timeline's MitoPure Skin Health line. Timeline's MitoPure ingredient is the first and only bioactive clinically proven to re-energize cells by rebuilding the mitochondria. This is going to combat your skin's natural age-associated energy decline in a whole new way. When we look at randomized clinical studies on MitoPure, they were able to demonstrate a reduction in wrinkle depth, an increase in the genes linked to collagen production and organization, and a downregulation or decrease of the genes associated with collagen degradation. It was also shown to enhance the resilience of skin cells when they are exposed to UV light damage. That doesn't mean you can't go with UV protection like a sunscreen, but it does help your skin's natural resilience to it. I use both the day and the night cream when I want my skin to be dewy and glowy, just like a glazed donut. So go to timeline.com/better and use code BETTER to get 10% off of your order. That's timeline.com/better and use code BETTER at checkout for 10% off. Dr. Don Lehman, I am just thrilled to welcome you to the show. Welcome to Better.
My pleasure. Great to join you.
Let's first start sort of 30,000 foot forest from the trees. Let's talk a little bit about the function that muscle serves. Clearly, there's an ambulatory or mobility function, and we can talk about that. I would love for you to talk also about the metabolic role that muscle plays in the body. And then I would also maybe add that for women specifically, there's also a menstrual balancing effect that can also be derived from regular stimulus of the muscle. So there's mobility. Let's alliterate our M's: mobility, metabolism, potentially menstrual. So maybe talk a little bit about the metabolic role that muscle plays in our body.
The last of the three I know the least about, so I'll probably skip that one. But certainly, I think we all start with muscle and we think about mobility and we think about athletes. But certainly as we get older, our functional mobility is a big issue. I always like to, make people aware that, for people who get beyond 60, 65, one of the major problems with long-term health is falls and breaking, fractures and things. There are 300,000 hip fractures per year in the United States, and one-third of those people never leave the hospital. So mobility and becoming more frail and all that is a major issue for keeping muscles healthy. So that's certainly part of it. And related to that, I think one of the things people don't understand is that we're continuously rebuilding our muscle proteins. Every protein in the body has a finite lifetime, and we have to make somewhere between 250 and 300 grams of new protein per day. And so people think, well, I'm eating 65 or 100 or 165 grams of protein, but I still have to make 300. So that sort of says, metabolism is more complex than just, I eat 100 grams of protein and therefore I make 100. I mean, that's not how it works. So, I think that whole process is critical. That leads us into the metabolism. Muscle makes up, somewhere around 45% of our body weight and a huge amount of protein. It's very involved in each of the macronutrients. So protein, carbohydrate, and fat are all heavily metabolized there. And I think it's important that we think about each of them. Just from a standpoint of protein, since I started with that, we're making 250, 300 grams of protein per day. Only about 25% of that actually goes to muscle. The rest of it's for organs. And the organs always have a first priority. And so muscle is sort of the second priority at a meal. And that's why the meals become very important. And so we have that constant turnover. People often will talk about thermogenesis, or how much when you eat, and protein has a higher thermogenic rate. If you read freshman nutrition, it'll say, well, it's because it's harder to digest and absorb. But that's not it at all. The issue is muscle protein turnover is a very expensive process. And so that's all part of the meal regulation. So that's kind of a long-winded answer there, but we could come back to that. The other part, carbohydrate and fat, muscle is really a central part of metabolism of both carbohydrates and fat. So people who have insulin resistance begins in muscle. Muscle basically has a need for carbohydrates, but really only for high-end muscle performance. The basic fuel for muscle is actually fats. And so when we think about regulation of blood glucose and fatty acids, it all begins in muscle. If muscles are healthy, our chances of not having diabetes go, you know, we're protected. If muscles are healthy, our blood lipids are more stable. So I'll stop rambling at this point and just say, you know, as we look at things like fasting blood glucose, insulin sensitivity, that starts in muscle. As we look at lipids in the blood, triglycerides, free fatty acids, that's all centered in the muscle. So if we balance our diet and balance our physical activity correctly, then all of those other metabolic things fall into place. And that's what Gabrielle and I always refer to as muscle-centric health, but it's also sort of protein-centric diets.
Right. And let's actually break down protein a little bit more, because I know we talk about protein targets, but what we're talking about is amino acids, right? So there's the 11 amino acids that we can synthesize, and then there's 9 that we need to get from our diet. This is sort of leading me in a little bit into sourcing of protein, but I would love to talk a little bit about the metabolic role of some of these different amino acids have, and why those are important for us to be thinking about as well when we're thinking about choosing the type of protein that we're going to be incorporating into the diet.
Yeah, I like to use the analogy, and you've probably heard me use it before, is that protein is really just sort of a food source of amino acids. It's kind of like a vitamin pill. We don't really have a need for the pill. We have a need for the 14 vitamins inside of it. And that's really what protein is. Protein is like a vitamin pill. It's simply a food source that delivers amino acids. There are 20 amino acids that we call naturally occurring that are in our food. And as you mentioned, 11 of them we can actually make. So if we get one amino acid, we could actually make a different one from it. But there are 9 that we actually have a daily requirement for, and we call those essential or indispensable. And of those, each of those have metabolic roles. We always think about, you know, again, freshman nutrition, amino acids are building blocks for new protein, which is true, but they also have individually metabolic roles. And so an amino acid like lysine is directly used for the formation of carnitine, which directs fatty acid oxidation. Phenylalanine is the direct precursor to tyrosine, which is important for dopamine in the brain and cognitive function and memory. Tryptophan, serotonin for mood. All of these are very related to the amount you eat. So if you have a very low protein diet, all of these other functions, mood, cognitive function, memory, fatty acid oxidation, all of those are downplayed. Another one I like is threonine. 75% of the threonine in your diet goes for producing the mucin in the lining of your gut. So we talk about prebiotics and probiotics. Probably the most important one is threonine, which produces the protective lining. And then, you know, my favorite, which I know you know, is leucine, which is a direct relationship for a signal to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. So there's lots of these metabolic roles. And I actually published 2 papers in the last year arguing it's time that we stop talking about protein. It's like saying we need a vitamin pill and start talking about the 9 essential amino acids, because that's what we actually need. And that then leads us into issues of all proteins aren't equal. You know, amino acids aren't equal in every protein. So
Yeah. And we're going to dive into that. I, as you were talking around mood and affect, just yesterday, my son, and they're both competitive soccer players, and we are very big on protein. So in the house, we often say, like, did you rack up your protein points? So if they want something sweet or they want something, we'll say a little bit more gluttonous, you know, it's usually like a fat and carb combination of something. It's like, you have to have enough protein points first. And yesterday my son came home and he's about 13 years old, and he came home. He was in the worst mood. He was crabby, irritable, just like snapping at everything. And I said, what did you eat today? Like, what did you have? And I know he had gone out for lunch with his friends, and there was only carbohydrates. He had only had basic, I mean, maybe there was a gram somewhere, you know, accumulated of protein. I was like, you sit down and you have some ground beef, and then we're going to talk. And literally within 25 minutes, I said, oh, my Andreas is back. Like, my normal son, you know, is back.
I can totally relate. My birthday was yesterday, and I must admit, I did carbohydrate loading. And so I had to get my protein back balanced today.
Yeah. So it's really sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll sort of joke and say, okay, is it because you're moody because you're tired? You haven't had enough protein? Like, what is actually driving this, you know, this aberrant mood or this sort of, you know, sulky predisposition that he had yesterday? So just as a little fun aside, back to amino acid requirement. And I just want to touch on this briefly, and then we'll dive into MPS and mTOR and leucine. But this is around the idea of nitrogen balance. And I'm saying this because the vast majority of people who listen to the show are women, typically perimenopausal and menopause. And one of the biggest challenges I find with my beautiful women is that we still have this hang up around somehow that meat or just a lot of protein is a very male centric effort. It's like men, fire, grill, barbecue, you know, rather than yes, it's also important for you as well. So can we talk briefly about nitrogen balance and how the maybe inefficiency of protein assembly changes with age? And we want to be thinking about not only the protein that we're taking in, but potentially also the protein that we're or I should say maybe more accurately, the nitrogen that we're taking in, but also how we may be losing on the other end of nitrogen, like when we're thinking about nitrogen balance, like nitrogen in versus nitrogen out.
Sure. You touched on sort of quality of proteins, and that'll be useful to come back to. What we know is that early in life, our whole body development is very heavily driven by hormones, insulin, growth hormone, IGF-1. And so I started my career studying malnutrition in Africa, and we know that children can grow with really bad diets, you know, without being, you know, just absolutely deficient. They will still grow and develop, and we can reproduce, and that's probably all survival. But somewhere after age 30, we start getting into that aging phenomena. That's a vague, you know, is it 30 or 40? I don't know. But by 40, we know that we begin to have a downward decline in certain metabolic aspects. And one of those is our rate of protein turnover. So I mentioned that we have to make 300 grams of protein per day. But as we get older, we get less efficient at that. And the older we get, the more inefficient we get. And so our ability to repair our body structures, you know, if you sprain an ankle or break a bone, it takes a lot longer to repair that when you're 65 than it does when you're 16. And right. There's reasons for that are all metabolic. But one of the great discoveries by Bob Wolf and the Galveston group in the late 90s, the same time we were discovering the leucine story, they discovered that basically, while there's a decrease in efficiency as we get older in protein turnover, if you give more protein, you can overcome it. So the capacity is still there. And so what we know in the aging process is that you don't need less protein. You actually need more protein and of a higher quality. So you need protein with more of those essential amino acids, and you need a higher amount of them. So nitrogen balance, protein, as we get older, those terms become more misleading because we sort of now are interacting with aging. And what we can do when we're 16 or 25, we can't do when we're 55 or 65. And so we need a different approach.
So the protein handling gets poorer, but you can overcome that by increasing your protein intake. And this is going to lead very beautifully into protein quality as well.
And that's really where the leucine story comes in. When you're 16, you're not really very sensitive to leucine. If you have a 10-gram meal of protein, you'll develop protein synthesis. If you have a 20-gram, you'll develop twice as much. When you're over 40, we know that a 10-gram meal, a 20-gram meal will have zero effect on muscle protein synthesis. The body is insensitive to it. And we know that you become more and more sensitive to the leucine amount in the meal to actually trigger protein synthesis. So, how we regulate as a 20-year-old is totally different than how we regulate after 40.
That's so interesting too. So let's talk about protein quality, but I just want to make a comment here because it is, my kids are, they're boys. So we have, the insulin and the IGF-1 that you mentioned. There's also, of course, and especially as they go through puberty in the next couple of years, we're going to also see that surge of androgen hormones, testosterone being one of them, of course. And then it's interesting. So after we get to 30 or 40, as much as I think that 30 or 40 is still relatively young, but, in the aging process and sort of what you're describing here, we are no longer driven by these hormones, but then what is it? Is it just it's the leucine, it's the type, it's the increase in protein that can still drive the MPS? Are there any other factors that contribute to that? So the younger we have this hormonal environment.
The hormones aren't really driving it anymore. So insulin, growth hormone are still important. If you were totally devoid, that would be a big problem. But they're just really kind of baseline. They have to be there. It takes very little insulin to actually be involved in protein synthesis when you're older. But what we now know is the body then becomes totally sensitive to resistance exercise, and the protein, and particularly a signal leucine. And we can go into a little more detail, but leucine is what we call a branch-chained amino acid, and there are three of them, leucine, valine, isoleucine. And those three are totally unique in that they're really only metabolized in skeletal muscle. And for whatever evolutionary reason, and we don't really have any clue, all the other amino acids, the other 17, are metabolized mostly in the liver, but these three are only metabolized in the muscle. And so the muscle has evolved to recognize those as a meal signal. When you eat a meal, the muscle sees exactly how much leucine you ate. And when it reaches a certain threshold, it says, oh, okay, that meal was adequate. I can turn on protein synthesis. And so if you only have a 15-gram meal of protein, muscle won't see enough leucine to turn it on. Where if you have a 35-gram meal of protein, muscle will say, I've got enough protein to turn on this very expensive process of muscle protein synthesis. People need to understand that the body regulates liver synthesis of protein very differently. In the middle of night when you're starving, the body has to be making liver proteins. If it stops, you die immediately. So where does the liver get its amino acids? Well, it gets it from muscle during the middle of the night. So muscle becomes what we call catabolic. And so we have to replace that every day. And the only way you replace it is having meals that have more than 30 grams of protein. So if you go through the day with very small meals of protein, you'll protect your liver, but your muscle will be continuously catabolic. And we think that's a huge issue of aging, particularly in adult women. We know that 40% of women over 60 actually are below the RDA, which is about 56 grams per day. That's extremely low, and probably accounts for both muscle problems and bone problems in older women.
And coming back to the idea of protein inefficiency or being able to assimilate the protein. So you mentioned 30 grams of protein being sort of the minimum requirement. We're going to get to protein quality, but you're bringing up all these amazing points that I just want to go down this other rabbit hole for a moment. Does that change then with age? Because then does 30 become insufficient for a 45 or a 55 or a 65 year old woman, or does she continue need to increase the bolus of protein as she ages?
So you're asking a question that's actually a little beyond the research at this moment. We don't really know. So, you know, does a 70 year old have a different need than a 50 year old? We don't really know that. The research has been done. We know that there's a huge difference between a protein intake that supplies less than 2 grams of leucine and a protein intake that supplies 3 grams. We can tell the difference in that. But can we tell the difference between 3.0 and 3.1? Our methods aren't that sophisticated. So I think the general answer to your question is, we know that the minimum threshold for leucine is around 2.5 in a 60-year-old. We tend to use the term 3 grams, which kind of addresses your issue. Does it go down some with aging? We say, well, you should really target 3 grams at a meal. And that kind of addresses it. But the reality is, we can't really answer your question, but we suspect it probably goes down with aging. But there's so many other things going on. You need less total calories. A 70-year-old needs a lot less calories than a 50-year-old. So you have to have a higher nutrient density. There's just all kinds of things going on. And frankly, we haven't been able to study it that refined yet.
And this is also one of the reasons that I have really departed from the concept of fasting, particularly in the first half of the day. So you talked about this idea of the muscles literally feeding, becoming catabolic in order to feed the liver, in order to feed systemically the body. Yeah. And they will stay catabolic, sounds like, until you reach that sort of minimum required, you know, minimum effective dose, let's say of 30 grams of protein or about 3 grams of leucine. And so for the women who are fasting, let's say until 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, or even I would say the OMAD groups, so like the one meal a day, you know, you are waiting. Often it's, you know, the meal a day happens in the evening. You are waiting so long, like your muscles have spent now 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours in this catabolic state. So the net result, I would assume over time, is that maybe you lose weight, but your body composition actually changes. You become like a skinny fat. You become relatively fatter, even though maybe you've changed your absolute weight.
Yeah. So, you know, we've done some studies, actually quite a few studies, looking at weight loss. So you're talking about time-restricted feeding or fasting, et cetera. I don't recommend fasting for anybody over 30 ever. So, you know, 36, 48, 72-hour fasting, some people think that's somehow a cleanse. I think that is a muscle loss that is never recoverable in an older adult. So, you know, a 25-year-old can pull that off, but a 65-year-old should never do that. Time-restricted feeding as a strategy for calorie balance, my opinion is the more catabolic you are, the earlier that meal should be, just for the same points you're making. So you're coming out of the overnight fast. But if you're a daily exerciser who's doing resistance exercise and basically healthy and having a good protein level, if you want to consolidate that into two meals, I think that's okay. I'm not a fan of one meal per day in older adults ever, but two meals, one at 11 and one at 7. I sometimes practice that, but I go to the gym every day. I do resistance exercise. So if you're more catabolic, for example, 75% of Americans are sedentary. They're catabolic most of the time. If you're trying to do weight loss, you're more catabolic. I think then your first meal should be as early as you wake up. You need to get out of that catabolic period as soon as possible because you're inherently catabolic anyway. So again, I think who you are kind of makes a difference. If you have a good protein intake, you're doing a lot of resistance exercise, and your first meal doesn't start till 11, I think you're perfectly fine. But if you're inherently trying to lose weight, you're inherently sedentary, you're 65, then you should be eating that protein within 30 minutes of waking up.
Okay, I'm going to come back to training because I have a lot of questions about it, but I do want to make sure that we get to protein quality. So I always get a little bit in trouble online when I talk about this because I think people can be so, you know, you just, you have a sort of worldview, you have a schema, you sort of filter things through that schema. And then when there's information that is presented that maybe opposes that framework, it can be, for some who are not willing to sort of let new information in, it can be very activating for them. So I would love for you to talk about the difference here in protein quality when we're talking about animal proteins versus plant-based proteins. And I'd love for you to talk about this, and you do so beautifully, around the bioavailability and absorptability of some of these proteins and the differences sort of that lies within, like, sort of between the two camps.
Yeah. So let's just start with the animal proteins. So animal proteins, we've talked about the essential amino acids, those nine, and they're in very specific balances. We need about 1 gram of methionine. We need about 6 to 7 grams of leucine. We need 3 grams of lysine. So we need, just like we need specific, you know, we need 60 milligrams of vitamin C. They're exact amounts. And it importantly, all animal proteins, whether it's meats or dairies or eggs or fish, have exactly the right balance for humans. Not surprisingly, plants have exactly the right balance for plants. Plants make leaves and stems and roots and seeds and flowers, which are pretty different than brains and hearts and livers and limbs, you know, arms. So people need to understand that the plants aren't making proteins, amino acids for us. They're making them for themselves. And so they're not in the right balance. And you'll see proteins like quinoa will often advertise that it has all the essential amino acids. Well, it does, but they're in totally the right balance. And to get enough leucine to actually trigger muscle protein synthesis would require about 7 cups of quinoa at a meal. So, you know, is quinoa a great food? It is, but it's actually a great carbohydrate food. It has a great fiber content. It has great nutrient content, but its protein's actually pretty crappy. You know, it just isn't very good. So, you know, I like to say, you know, things like chili are a perfect kind of food. You can have a meat in it. You can have your beans in it. You can have vegetables, onions, green peppers, tomatoes, whatever. It's a perfect blend of all of the different foods, using both plant and animal foods to get the right balance. So the problem with plant is the amino acids are in the wrong balance. And then the other part of it, again, the amino acids are there for the plant. So about 50% of those proteins are attached to fiber. They're part of the structural part of the plant, and humans don't digest fiber. And so the amino acids or the proteins that are in the plant aren't available to us. So when we see something like a whole grain cereal that says it, just for easy numbers, let's say it says it has 10 grams of protein in a serving, it's probably only 40% available. The bioavailability of protein from wheat, gluten, is very poor, probably about 40%. And so instead of having 10 grams in that serving, it only has 4. So where animal proteins are 100% bioavailable, most plant proteins are somewhere between 40 and 60%. So when you see it has 10, at best, you're probably getting 5 out of it.
So if a 55-year-old or 45-year-old woman says, hey, I'm plant-based, I'm vegetarian, for whatever reason, whether it's an ethical or economical or whatever environmental reason that they don't want to be consuming meats or animal-based proteins, they would by necessity need to consume more calories in order to sort of equate with the same physiological or metabolical consequences that we're talking here in a 45 or 55-year-old woman who's consuming animal proteins, yes?
Right. So, you know, we've looked at vegetarian and vegan type of meals. The average vegetarian in the U.S. is about 65 grams per day. The average vegan's around 55. We've done some modeling of looking at essential amino acid needs. And what we know is that if you get below about 50% of your protein coming from animal protein, you can no longer meet your essential amino acid needs with a plant-based diet. So to your point, you have to increase both the total amount of protein, and that means the total calories. And so typically, vegetarians and vegans decrease their protein when in fact they need to increase their total amount. So it's perfectly possible to be vegetarian or vegan, but you're going to have a lot of food knowledge about essential amino acids to balance that. You're going to have to either dramatically increase your calories or going to a lot of ultra-processed foods where you're using isolated proteins to help keep the calories down. The problem in most plant-based protein, whether it's beans or seeds or nuts or whatever, your calorie ratio in beans and legumes, for example, you're going to get about 3 or 4 to 1 carb to protein ratio. So right. If you're trying to hit 100 grams of protein, you're going to get at least 300 grams of carbs, you know, which is 1200 calories just in carbohydrates. So there's just a lot of difficult problems, and it doesn't mean you can't do it, but it takes a lot of food knowledge and a lot of food skills to make that work. And again, the average adult in the U.S. doesn't have either the knowledge or the food skills to pull that off. So recommending it blindly that we all should have more plant-based diets might sound good, but that's a route to very poor adult health.
I could not agree more. I am a huge fan of the Bio-Optimizers Magnesium Breakthrough. It has 7 forms of magnesium, which is going to help to transform your stress and your performance and your recovery and your sleep to the next level. I'm often asked, like, well, what are the types of magnesium we should be looking for? So there's magnesium chelate and citrate and bisglycinate and malate, sucrosomial, taurate, and orotate. They have various effects on the body. Bisglycinate, probably the most bioavailable and most absorbable. Malate, it's found naturally in fruits, helps with migraines. Chronic pain has been shown to help improve depression. Magnesium citrate helps with arterial stiffness, helps with maintaining a healthy weight. Magnesium chelate is important for muscle building, recovery, and health. The list goes on and on. You're basically getting them all in one supplement. Each supplement itself is 500 milligrams of magnesium, which I feel is such a great dosage as a great baseline for most women. I have found a beautiful medium of actually cycling my magnesium. So I actually will take 1 or 2 of these. So I'm either getting 500 milligrams or up to 1 gram of magnesium, depending on where I am in my cycle. So head on over to biooptimizers.com/better and use code better for 10% off of any order, but make sure that the magnesium breakthrough is in your cart. So let's come back to vegetarians and vegans. You said the vegetarians usually 60, like the on average you were looking at, they were taking in about 65 grams of plant-based proteins, vegans about 55 grams. Is there a way that we can support these vegetarians and like, would it be, you know, the bioavailability, for example, just knowing your work, I know that, you know, soy protein is more bioavailable. So would we counsel them to maybe get like a powdered plant protein, and then they're instead of having the 65 or the 55 grams of plant proteins, we can get them up to like 85, 100 grams, 120 grams with sort of plant.
I mean, your statement is exactly right. What to remember is that soy protein isn't unto itself novel. If you eat it as edamame, the bioavailability is only 60% or less. But if you do process it and isolate it out as a powder, a protein powder, then the bioavailability is up in the 90s. So now you have a powder that you can use, and you can make a shake or a product out of it. But again, you're now basically shifting from what we might say are natural foods to ultra-processed foods to make that work. So the two things I would recommend to vegetarians or vegans are they do need to bring in some plant powders, and they also need to be very conscious of resistance exercise, because their muscles are at risk because they're going to have a lower protein diet. And one of the ways you can increase the efficiency of the protein and also protect your muscles is with resistance exercise. So two things I always recommend is, you know, you need to be physically active, you need resistance exercise, you probably need powders. And that's one of the reasons that most vegetarians are under the age of 40. The average vegetarian in the United States is between 20 and 40. Why? Because it's easier to be physically active and have these other products and eat more calories. It's very difficult for a 65-year-old to be vegan.
It's also illegal, I think, to raise your children as vegan. I think you are not allowed to do that because you run the risk of malnutrition.
I mean, it should be, but it's not in the United States, unfortunately.
Yeah. I have heard of, I know in the UK there was, I think there was a child who died of malnutrition, and the government, or, you know, the country, I guess it would be the government, ended up suing them for child neglect because you have to give children.
Yeah, I mentioned early in my career, I worked in Africa in childhood malnutrition. And one of the things we saw was, you know, children will survive on very poor diets, but they have very low muscle mass. And what that means is it predestines them to be obese. If you don't develop your muscle mass in your, you know, up to through your 25, 30 age, you can't develop it very well. It puts some limits on the maximum muscle mass you can get. And that's what I think you sort of alluded to it early. That's sort of skinny fat. And that's what we see in a country like India, where basically, I think they're number two in the world in diabetes. But if you look at them, they all look fairly thin. And it's because they have almost no muscle mass. So they're what we call skinny fat. So they're extremely low in muscle, they're metabolically challenged, and they're very prone to insulin resistance and diabetes.
It's interesting too. I think we have lots of examples in history of this as well. I know my son is really into the world wars and European history. So we know, or at least he's told me about, and there's documented evidence of this, when the Germans had, I think they had bombed, was it the Netherlands? And then they had sort of not allowed food to get into the country for whatever reason. There was some retaliation. I don't know the details of that, but that winter, there were so many, the women who were pregnant at that time ended up giving birth to these children who, you know, so the mother didn't get enough protein, the mother didn't get enough total calories, and with that, of course, total protein. And then their children, once those children were born, if they survived, all became obese, like without any, like 100% of them became obese. And so they followed this sort of cohort of individuals over the course of their lives, and they always struggled with that. So what you're saying here, I think, if I'm summarizing it, and redirect me if I'm incorrect here, is even though in our youth we are driven more by insulin and IGF-1, if you still don't meet a minimum requirement of protein intake, you are basically setting yourself up for sarcopenia and obesity together.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there malnutrition in Africa. I think you're referring to the Stalingrad studies in Russia that came out of World War II. We see it in India. So we see it around the world that, you know, if you don't develop it correctly as a child, you go through those critical growth periods, you can always add some muscle later in life, but you're always limited sort of by your DNA. We call them satellite cells. Your DNA and muscle will always limit you. And I did some early studies that were animal studies during my PhD, actually. And we sort of demonstrated that there are critical growth periods. And if you don't establish that muscle potential, you're basically stuck with it for the rest of your life.
Wow. Muscle potential. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about leucine. I know we've been flirting with it, but let's just dive right in. Leucine, and I'd like to actually talk about this with mTOR and MPS and muscle protein synthesis. And I wanted to start with mTOR because I think that there is some confusion around mTOR. We often hear things like, you always want to shut off mTOR. Like that's part of the justification for fasting for long periods of time. And we hear, you know, these sort of longevity drugs, rapamycin, metformin, all of these sort of acting on mTOR as an inhibit that pathway. And leucine is a potent, I mean, there are other activators, which we'll talk about, but it's also an amazing trigger for mTOR as well. So can you explain sort of the dichotomy, and maybe this comes into Walter Longo's research in the blue zones, but why some people believe that clamping down on mTOR is the way for us to live a longer life? And how can we sort of reconcile that with what we're talking about here, which is leucine being a potent activator of that growth pathway?
Yeah. So let's take a little bit bigger picture of it. I first got interested in leucine way back in graduate school when I realized it wasn't metabolized in liver. Okay, so that tells us something right away about mTOR. So the body has evolved to send leucine out to muscle as a specific muscle signal. If we look at mTOR, mTOR responds to a lot of different signals. It responds to insulin. It responds to carbohydrates, energy through something called AMP kinase. It responds to leucine, and it responds to exercise, particularly resistance exercise. So what that tells us is that the regulation of mTOR is different in different tissues. In liver, it responds to insulin. In the pancreas, it responds to insulin. In cancer cells, it responds to insulin. But in muscle, it responds to leucine. And so the folks like Longo, who have looked at longevity, basically have used rodents, which continuously eat 24 hours a day. You can wake up a mouse or a rat in the middle of the night, look at the stomach contents, and it will have just eaten. It's absorptive 24 hours a day. But as we were talking about earlier, humans actually eat at night and then go through a long fasting period. When you allow the animal models to eat continuously, what you do is activate insulin continuously.
All the time.
And that triggers mTOR in all of the tissues you don't want to trigger it in. But when you convert them to meal eating, like humans do, now what you do is you only trigger mTOR associated with meals, and it turns on and off. And so the issue is, the worst case scenario, and this kind of gets back to vegetarians, eating lots of small meals all day long is the worst thing you could possibly do for mTOR. What we want to do is have protein meals, probably 3 per day, where we turn it on and then let it turn off. Now we're doing the best we can for protecting muscle, which we know is probably the single most important thing for longevity, and we're trying to keep it shut off in the other tissues, so where it's not important. What we've done some actual cancer studies, and we know that insulin is a far bigger risk. Carbohydrates are a far bigger risk for tumor promotion than protein is. So again, if you're motivated by bias, which Longo is, you basically will tell one story. But if we actually look at the balance, we know that higher protein, lower carb is actually the better way to go for longevity, body composition, and muscle health.
And I think expanding on that, insulin, you know, when you are activating mTOR via insulin, which is carbohydrate consumption, this is more of a systemic activation, where it sounds like when we are activating mTOR in the muscle, obviously we have muscles all over the body, but it is one specific organ, you know, an aggregate of muscles through the body. It's specific to muscle tissue.
Exactly. And it's becomes more specific as we get older. When we're 16 or 20, insulin is still a fairly big activator in skeletal muscle. But once we stop growing, we know that if you look at age 10 to age 20, to have insulin stimulate muscle protein synthesis, it would take 4 times as much insulin to do it. We all become insulin resistant as we get older. People think of insulin as some major regulator, but the reality is insulin is a safeguard for adults. If the body gets exposed to too much blood sugar, we have to rely on insulin to get it back down. Insulin doesn't regulate our blood sugar. It's a safeguard against excess. And if we continuously challenge that excess, that's what causes insulin resistance. If we expose the body to too much sugar, blood glucose, day after day after day, muscle basically becomes insensitive. Glucose is, in fact, toxic in the body. We have to have it, But the body has a very real limit to it. The brain needs it. The red blood cells need it. But basically beyond that, we have very little way of getting rid of it other than extreme exercise. And so the muscles become insensitive, blood glucose goes up, and that's what is diabetes. You know, blood glucose, carbohydrates are something the body regulates very carefully, and it has its own disease, diabetes.
Do we have, in the same way that we have sort of a minimum effective dose of 30 grams of protein in order to turn the muscles from being catabolic to stimulating muscle protein synthesis, is there a limit, would you say, on carbohydrate consumption on a per meal or per, or maybe daily? I don't know. I mean, of course, it's going to vary by age and muscle
most
tissue.
People, So most people don't recognize that we talk about an RDA for protein, but there's an RDA for carbohydrates, and that's 130 grams per day. The average American's eating 300, so three times the RDA. So, you know, why are we obese? Well, we're eating, you know, we're eating 800 grams of carbohydrates more than we can metabolize. That's why. Where did those numbers come from? We have what we call an obligatory carbohydrate need, blood glucose need, and that's for the brain and the red blood cells and the kidney. And that's estimated at around 80 grams per day. And they put a little bit of a safety factor, and that's where the 130 comes from. Okay. So you have a minimum of around 100 grams per day of carbs that you probably need to eat. People will say, well, you can make it from protein, but I think that's a pretty inefficient way of getting carbs. But anyway, let's start with 100. Beyond that 100, every gram of carbohydrate you use, you have to earn with physical activity. And you earn it at about a rate of maybe 50 to 60 grams per hour. So for the average American eating 300 grams per day, they have to have at least 3 hours of high-intensity physical activity every day. And we know that 75% of Americans are sedentary, so they're not getting it, hence obesity. You know, that how much per meal, I've done quite a lot of work looking at things from Shulman and Bob Wolf and others who have done a lot of the metabolic work on flux. We can use about 20 grams of carbohydrate per hour in the body in a sedentary condition. So that means we have a meal limit somewhere around 30, possibly 40 grams of carbohydrate. Three meals, there's our 120. We have a meal limit of about 40. Beyond that, we need a very high insulin response to get rid of it. So we're not using it. So now we have to store it somewhere. People say, well, we store it in glycogen. Well, you only store it in glycogen if you've used the glycogen.
Right.
And how do you use glycogen? Well, you do muscle activity.
Squat. So if you got to squat while you're getting your carbs. That's what it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. So, you know, if you're sedentary, the only other place you can do it is force it into body fat. And when you do that, now you start getting very weird metabolism. You're insulin insensitive. You start getting high triglycerides. Your blood lipids are higher. You have higher free fatty acids. You get your fatty liver. You get all of the negatives we associated with, quote, higher fat diets, but they're actually driven by high carb diets.
That's so interesting because one of the things that we see in perimenopause and menopause, certainly, you know, we see this in men too, as you had mentioned, this sort of anabolic resistance, this insulin resistance at the level of the muscle. And we also see sort of a change in phenotype of fat as we age. So we go from subcutaneous fat, which is, you know, much to the disdain of every woman. We all want to get rid of it. Yeah. But what it changes as we become more insulin resistant to more of this visceral fat and like the development of what you're talking about is like NAFLD and non-alcoholic fatty
and
liver disease.
I assume you're familiar with it, you know, studying more of the hormone aspects that estrogen drives fat deposition in a female pattern where insulin drives it in a male pattern. Right. And so as you get the menopause and the hormones shift, now you get the visceral fat, which is far more metabolically insensitive, much more likely to be associated with diabetes or heart disease, the more male pattern of fat deposition.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is so, okay. So we know that we've been talking about all protein is not created equal. Do you have an opinion on carbohydrates being created equal? Are there carbohydrates that you prefer, don't prefer, recommend, don't recommend?
I think first and foremost, it's amount. Quantity is the number one issue. You know, carbohydrates that come in the form of beans and lentils and things like that are great sources of carbohydrate because they have very high fiber content. Their digestion is slower. So that's great. And even, you know, seeds and nuts and things like that. Yeah. Highly processed carbs, which are in, you know, the diet, like we, you know, you get in processed cereals or breads. I think the single worst carbohydrate on the market is wheat. And in the United States, actually worldwide, 80% of the plant-based protein in the world comes from wheat. Wheat is deficient in at least 4 different essential amino acids. And so 80% comes from wheat. That's a major problem with vegetarians. And my comment earlier, vegetarians need a lot of food knowledge and a lot of food skills. Mm-hmm. You can't just opt out to say, I'm going to eat more cereal and bread because it's totally unhealthy. You know, so what we think of as healthier plant-based foods of beans and lentils and you know, nuts and seeds, those are true. But if you look at the people in the United States who have the highest plant-based diet, they get less than 9% of their protein from those groups. 80% comes from wheat. And so, if you're going to do it, you need to know what to do, and you need to make a lot better choices than what people have demonstrated they're doing.
Gosh, I have friends who are vegetarians, and yeah, it's like you can get there with plants, but you just really need to do your jurisprudence is what I think you're. Yeah,
it's tough, and you better be physically active. You better be using muscle to protect your muscle mTOR, muscle structure, your muscle strength, because having a low protein diet, you know, having protein intakes less than 70 grams is not going to do it as you get older.
Yeah. Okay. So let's actually talk about training. So we've been talking a lot about the chemical stimulus on muscle and muscle protein. And of course, there's a mechanical one as well when you're resistance training or doing some kind of, you know, we can talk about, you know, HIIT and some of those other, maybe some cardiovascular work, not as much as training. But let's talk about protein timing. So protein intake timing relative to or in relation to exercise or strength training. So we talked before about the muscles being catabolic, you know, overnight, and they're feeding the organs, et cetera. And they don't stop being catabolic until we reach this 30 grams minimum or 3 grams, we'll say, of leucine, which is about, you know, 30 grams of animal protein. Do you recommend having protein prior to resistance training and then maybe carbohydrates afterwards because you've earned your carbs? Like what is your thinking around protein intake in relation to exercise?
So to your question, the answer is no.
No protein prior to training.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know of any good data that protein ahead of exercise is useful. There's one study by Kevin Tipton. We've done studies with rats and humans. We see no benefit of protein ahead of time. The body goes through a catabolic period during exercise, whether you have it ahead of time or not. So contrary to what a lot of trainers believe, I see no benefit at all ahead of time. I think there may be satiety. So now we ask how far ahead, what's your pregame meal going to look like? I think having protein at a pregame meal 2 hours ahead helps you feel good, helps you have energy, but it's not going to protect your muscle, okay? So there's different reasons to have protein. Protein after exercise, we're guilty of actually starting this nonsense. What we know is that with extreme exercise, muscle becomes catabolic. And so we use that model to actually discover the leucine mTOR. So protein synthesis is regulated at two distinct levels. One is what we call transcriptional, which is gene level. And that's where your hormones come in. That's what testosterone and estrogen do. They regulate the amount of RNA you have. They regulate your capacity. Where diet actually regulates more of what we call the translational level, and that's leucine and mTOR, meal to meal. Okay. So what we wanted to do was create a catabolic condition that we knew only affected the translational level, the mTOR level, and not the gene level. So we did our first experiments were an hour plus of intense exercise, and we created a catabolic period that downregulated protein synthesis. And we showed then that the body stayed that way until you ate protein. And so everybody jumped on that and said, well, you should have protein right after exercise for recovery. And people, you know, Halazi and others had always said you need carbohydrates for recovery too. So that's all true. The issue we now know is that the protein after exercise really only is critical in an untrained individual. If the person is well-trained, you really don't go through a catabolic period. If you're going out and you're training, you know, every day and you're running 10 miles getting ready for a marathon, and then you go out the day of your marathon and run 26, you're going to be catabolic. So you probably would get a benefit having protein soon after. But if you go to the gym and you're working out for an hour every day, doing exactly the same thing, it doesn't matter when your next meal is, whether it's 30 minutes later or 2 hours later, you're going to get the same benefit. So the whole idea of having protein timed exactly before or after exercise, I think people need to understand that that is an untrained, maximum performance, one-time acute effect. That's not routine. So I sort of downplay the timing around protein. I think that distributing it as 3 meals a day, maybe some athletes want to go for 4 meals a day, 4 to 5 hour intervals. I think that's great. Someplace in there you fit in your exercise, and chances are that exercise is within 2 hours of the next meal. I think that's fine. So these guys who are carrying protein supplements into the gym and chugging them on the way out are wasting money.
Wasting money. So, and that's because the muscle is still going to be catabolic. If you are moving the muscle, if you're training the muscle close to muscle failure, the muscle is still breaking down. So you are not going to prevent that.
Having protein ahead of time makes no sense. Afterwards, I think it's fine. But whether you have it 30 minutes afterwards or 2 hours, you're going to get the same net effect.
In a trained individual. So if you're someone who's regularly training, say, maybe it's, what would be a trained individual? More than a year? Someone who's trained more than So someone who's been training for longer than a year.
I would say really 4 months, you know. Someone who's doing basically the same training, they're skilled at it. It's no longer exhaustive. They can do it. It's pretty comfortable. So, a kid doing, football practice after the first week of being sore, you're basically trained. So there's no more benefit. During that first 2 weeks of fall football practice or soccer practice, having protein, there may be benefit to that. I don't have a problem with that. But again, these guys who are going to the gym every day, day in, day out, and buying expensive protein supplements, they're not getting a benefit from that.
Right, because it's the total protein in a 24-hour period at that point.
Exactly.
That's more important. Okay. Right. I will say, in the sort of spirit of transparency, I actually like to eat prior to a lift. I find that my performance in the gym, so I usually have like some protein and carbs in the morning, like some oatmeal and whey or whatever, but I'm not doing it because I'm trying to prevent catabolism. That's exactly what I want to happen in this session. It's because I find that it helps my performance. It helps me with some energy. Obviously I'm giving my body some substrate, but I've been training for decades. Forever.
And those are perfectly good reasons. I don't see any downside to doing it, but people who think that by having 30 grams of protein before they go to the gym, they're going to get bigger muscles they're kidding themselves. So, right. I play a lot of fairly intense tennis, and I have a very specific routine of what I have before I go to the gym. So I think everybody can evolve how they feel best. And I have no problem if it's a combination of protein and carbs. For me, I'm a little more carb heavy because I'm fairly aerobically intense and the carbs are important to me. But, you know, I don't have a problem with it. But again, they're kidding themselves if they think that's going to give them muscle hypertrophy.
And what about for high intensity interval training? So you mentioned tennis, which can be, there's a lot of side to side, there's a lot of start stop, and you know, it can be very intense there. What does a pre-meal look like, or
so
carbohydrate?
I think it's
intake?
Important for people to understand muscle fuel. So if you and I sitting here, our muscles are probably using about 80% fat and 20% carbs. As you begin to get more active, you go to walking, to running, et cetera, your carb fat use changes because the body can only use fats through the mitochondria, where it can use carbs through what we call glycolysis, anaerobic metabolism. Once you cross around 65% of your maximum performance, heart rate somewhere around 120, you become more and more carb oriented. So someone running, say, a 100-meter dash, they're going to run that dash fully on carbohydrates. And so the more intense your HIIT exercise, the more carbohydrates you probably need in your diet. I said I'm a tennis player. I will routinely play 2 hours. I eat around 180 grams of carbs per day because I'm burning, you know, I have at least a couple of hours where I'm burning it at 50, 60 grams per hour. And so that's how I'm basically bringing it into play. So when people think about exercise, they need to think about three levels. There's movement, walking, which basically burns calories and nothing else. You get no muscle benefit. Then there's aerobic, where you get cardiovascular. This means your heart rate is something above 100, maybe for a younger person, 160 beats per minute. The older you get, the lower it is. I try and hit 110, 120 for my activities. Now you're shifting to more carbohydrate expenditures. And then you have resistance exercise, which gives you muscle strength and hypertrophy. Three different kinds of exercise, three different benefits. I would argue we need all three of them. But anyway, your question about carbohydrates, again, I said earlier, you earn carbohydrates at about 50 to 60 grams per hour when your heart rate is above, continuously above 100 beats per minute.
So a lot of my women who listen to this show, and I also have a lot of clinicians here who counsel women, when we're thinking about fat loss, when we're thinking, and I'll caveat that by saying a lot of women talk about weight loss, but what we really want is we want fat loss. We don't want to lose muscle tissue. We don't want to lose brain tissue, organ tissue, bone density. We want, you know, usually in most cases, it's a reduction in adiposity or excess adiposity. When we are thinking about structuring a diet, if I, you know, can sort of summarize what you're saying, it seems like the protein has to be sort of first and foremost. We want to be thinking about a target protein per day. So it's not a percentage. It's like, this is the protein target. How would you, maybe you can expand on that and then maybe talk a little bit about how we might structure. So the carbohydrates, as we've talked about, earning your carbs at a rate of 50 grams per hour, at least I think you said like somewhere between 80 and 130 grams, or we'll say 100 sort of as a wash in the middle. And then where does fat come in?
Yeah. So let me talk about weight loss just before I get to the diet part. So What people need to understand, we talk some about fasting. If you just fast for a weight loss, you'll lose about 50% fat, 50% muscle. If you fast for 7 days, more of a starvation, you may lose 80% of your weight loss will be muscle and lean tissue. And that's not recoverable for a 60-year-old. So that's the problem with it. It's one of the problems of Ozempic, is that people will lose weight really quickly, but 50% of the weight loss is muscle, is lean tissue. Yeah. Unless you're doing high protein resistance exercise while you're using it. And if you watch the ads now, they're starting to emphasize that. So, you know, you've got to be concerned about the composition of the weight loss. We've published a number of studies that if you do resistance exercise and higher protein during the weight loss, we can make the weight loss, 95% fat, 5% muscle.
And Tell me more.
So that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
So how do we do it? We find that metabolically in women, if we can't keep them at 100 grams of protein per day, they'll tend to lose the metabolic advantages of protein.
Yeah.
So, you know, people will say, well, the RDA is only 65 and that's enough. Well, if you're in a catabolic condition, you're going to lose muscle mass. Probably at least 35% of your weight loss will be muscle, lean tissue, where if you do it correctly, you can make that almost nothing. So basically, we always went for 100 grams per day. We were always very specific about getting at least 30, 35, more like 35 at the first meal as you come out of the fast. And the way we taught it, we realize people don't like the count. Most people don't like to look at FACTS panels and look at grams of carbohydrates and protein. So the way we taught it was the visual concept of your protein and your carbohydrates need to look like they're equal size on the plate. And so if you have 30 grams of protein or 40 grams, so think about that in eggs or cheese or milk, or what does that look like in carbs? So basically, 4 ounces of meat will look like about a half cup of rice. That's how you balance it. So we wanted a one-to-one balance of protein and carbohydrate at meals. And what we found is that was very effective for weight loss. Fat, we basically wanted people not to think much about it. We wanted them to avoid fried foods. We wanted them to avoid things like French fries and chips and things like that. But we basically said, we don't want you to use fat-free things ever. We found that people who use skim milk lost the advantage, both the protein and the satiety. So we want reduced fat. We don't want a lot of excess fat, but we want it to be natural fat. If it comes with the food, that's fine. Be sensitive to it. It is calories. But if you control the protein and carb parts of the diet, and then just let the fat be natural, you'll control your calories.
And did you change the dosing of the protein through the day? So we've kind of been talking about this idea that the first meal that you have protein is very important.
We let people sort of pick their diet on that. We made them focus on getting 35 at the first meal, but we let them sort of float it. So if they liked having 55 at dinner, that's what they were used to, that was fine. Most of our studies, we actually ended up with about 35 at breakfast, 35 at lunch, and about 50 to 55 at dinner. But if they wanted, quote, dinner in the middle of the day, that was fine. They could float where they positioned the other meals. The only one we were specific about is that first meal had to have 35 and it had to occur within an hour or so of waking up.
Do you know what I like to do? I like to have big protein in the morning, and then I like to have big protein in the evening. I don't know. It just makes, I don't feel like I need a lot of protein at lunchtime. I have some.
Obviously. You know, the reality is we have really good data about the protein at breakfast. We have pretty good data about protein at dinner, and we have zero data about protein at lunch. And so Doug Patton Jones and I unfortunately ran a study where we made an even distribution of protein through the day, and everybody decided that's what it is. That's not what that study actually showed. What we did was we moved 30 grams of protein from dinner into breakfast. And that's what the study really showed, is that we repositioned the protein they were already eating. So I frequently am like you. I will have my typical breakfast has 40 to 45 grams of protein. My typical lunch will have 15 to 20 in the form of a salad or something light.
Yeah,
and then I'll have 50 to 60 at dinner. And that's my personal pattern.
Yeah, I like that too. And I just, there's something about having more protein in the evening. It's satiating. It allows me to kind of get through the night. Like, I don't wake up hungry. And when I wake up, you know, there's, I try to eat, you know, as I mentioned before, I train, but I love the satiety inducing effects of a nice big protein bolus in the evening. I don't know what it is. I'm happy.
And I don't like a big lunch. It makes me sleepier. You know, I don't seem as alert. to some extent, it even makes me hungrier if I eat more at lunch. So my midday meal tends to be pretty light.
Wonderful. Well, I have absolutely loved this conversation. If people want to learn more about your work, where can I direct people to find you?
My Twitter account is just at Don Lehman, which is pretty easy to find. My website is called metabolictransformation.com. And we actually have a couple of protein shakes. We have a new one coming out in the next couple of weeks. So people always ask me, well, how do you do breakfast? Well, the website, you know, we found that people had trouble doing it. So we actually developed meal replacements. So they're not protein shakes, they're meal replacements. And the other great source is Gabrielle's book, you know, Forever Strong, is a great sort of presentation of everything we've done over the years. So it's a great read and kind of goes into depth about all the stuff we've discovered.
I love that. And yeah, so I'll make sure that all of that is in the show notes as clickable links. And it has just been a delight. Dr. Lehman, thank you so much for your time, your energy, your brilliance, your focus today. I really appreciate it.
It's been great fun, Stephanie. We'll do it again sometime.
Yes.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.